Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media Network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion, and I have written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture and relevant to our purposes today. I've been playing Dungeons & Dragons since 2007, so for almost 16 years now, which kind of blows my mind. But welcome to the rest of our panel today. Of course, joining me is my co-host, Liz. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, a D&D newbie, and a Latter-day Saint.
And Shannon, if you could introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Shannon Oler. I've been playing D&D for about a year and a half, and actually I was introduced by somebody who learned how to DM from Carl, and now I'm DMing a game for my family, and I play an Arakocra fighter with a crossbow in our current campaign. We're doing Tomb of Annihilation, and it's a ton of fun. I really have enjoyed D&D since we got into it. I wish that I had discovered it 20 years ago, but I'm trying to make up for lost time.
So in the parlance of a mission, like how you say, my trainer is my dad, and then his trainer was my grandpa. So Shannon's like my Dungeons & Dragons granddaughter, and I'm here for it. It's great. And Parker, if you would introduce yourself, please.
I'm Parker Sappington. I co-host a podcast called Not One Nerds, where we explore various tabletop role-playing games, including Dungeons & Dragons. Been playing Dungeons & Dragons for about 5 years now, and currently playing one campaign while I am the Dungeon Master for a whole other campaign, both of which I get to share with my wife.
The party I'm running for right now, it keeps trying to get Susan to play with us, but she has kids to watch, so we'll get there someday. She's played with me before, and she enjoys it too. But before we get into our discussion of Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, we will be talking about the movie at some point in this podcast, which is a quick jaunt through the realms of Faerun. Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez star as the leaders of a band of mercenaries trying to stop the world from ending and find some family along the way and redeem themselves from mistakes they've made in the past. But before we get into that, we're going to have our best books segment where we each recommend one thing that we are watching, reading, or listening to. My recommendation this time is Servant of the People, which you can find on Netflix. It stars Volodymyr Zelensky, who you might know as the actual president of Ukraine right now. He was a comedian and started this TV show about a random school teacher whose rant about the corruption of the government goes viral, and then he randomly becomes and is elected the president of Ukraine. I'm only 5 or 6 episodes into it, but even just watching those first 5 or 6 episodes is really interesting to see just the level of corruption in their country that is just assumed and that they use as jokes and things to make fun of. And I can tell where he's going with the, he's going to try to fix some of these things. But it's also interesting to see their view of America. At least the first season started off during the Obama era. And it's interesting to see, for example, his mom and his sister trying to go to the mall where they want to buy dresses and gowns for his inauguration because they want to look like Michelle Obama. And there are comments as the news media like follows his family around to these mall shopping stores and things about how Michelle Obama's kind of set the tone for all future women in politics with their husbands or sons, in this case, uncles, whatever, being elected president. And it's just such an interesting view, both of what another country that is dysfunctional is, and then to see America through that lens is really interesting. Of course, right after it finished airing, he was actually elected president of Ukraine. And so here we are. I don't know. It's this weird case of life imitating art. So Servant of the People on Netflix is my recommendation this time. Liz, what have you got for us this round?
So my recommendation is a book called In Gathering, The Complete People Stories by Zena Henderson. Zena Henderson was a member of the church until she got divorced in like her 30s, and then she married a Methodist minister. But she was a big sci-fi writer in the 50s and 60s and was a major influence on people like Orson Scott Card, and Anne McCaffrey also cites her as influenced. So this is like her collected story. She's dropped out of our collective memory, but she was really big back in the 50s and 60s. This is a collection of her short stories, and they've got like a bridging frame story that ties them all together into one continuous story. And they're very hopeful stories about a group of aliens who have fled their dying world, and they were coming to Earth, and their spaceship broke up in the atmosphere, and they've ended up in little pockets throughout the American Southwest. And they look like normal people, but they have magical powers, like they can read minds, tell the future. They call it lifting, but essentially fly and telekinesis, kind of things like that. And it's a very interpersonal kind of sci-fi because it's all about relationships and belonging and these fragmented groups of the people who've been scattered all over, finding each other and realizing they're not alone and that they're not a freak, that there are people like them who will accept them. They're just super interesting stories, very different from what I've been reading in modern science fiction. So I highly recommend you pick up a copy. I think you can only really get it in ebook format because it's out of print, but that's In Gathering by Zena Henderson.
I'm definitely going to put that one on my list. That scratches several of my itches, right? LDS fiction writers and science fiction from the golden age of the 50s and 60s and with influence on some of the people that I really enjoyed growing up reading, like Orson Scott Card and Anne McCaffrey. So there you go. Shannon, what do you have to recommend to our listeners this session?
That makes me want to change my recommendation to Everything by Anne McCaffrey, but I'll go ahead with
you can do that.
We'll stick that in there too.
Yeah, but I wanted to recommend, this might be my only chance to recommend a book on a podcast. So I'm going to go with A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson. Was written in the 90s. It's not science fiction. He's a travel writer and he's middle-aged and overweight, and he decides that he wants to thru-hike the entire Appalachian Trail and write a book about it. So he goes in, basically, he reads a bunch of books about it and finds out like how common it is to run into bears along the way and stuff. And he has brand new equipment and he decides to bring his friend with him from the Midwest. And his friend is even less prepared. He has a 100-pound backpack that he brings with him. And he says he hasn't gone an hour without a donut for a long time. So he's not sure how that's going to work out. And they just start hiking the trail. And it's really funny. It's a mix between Garrison Keillor and Dave Barry, if you're old enough to know who those are. And it's just really amusing, and I really love it. But it also like talks about the ecology of the Appalachian Trail and the history of it. And it's really interesting as I come from Idaho and I'm trying to learn. I mean, I've been in Maryland for a while now, but I'm still trying to get to know the local flora and fauna. So it was really interesting for me. I think everyone would enjoy it.
I am a big fan of Bill Bryson. He is hilarious. His books are so funny. I have heard that they made this one into a movie, and I have not seen it yet.
Yeah,
but it stars Robert Redford as Bill Bryson.
Yeah, I think he just loved the book and decided to make a movie about it. I heard it was middling as far as movies go, but might still be funny.
And Parker, what do you have to share with our listeners this time?
Initially, I was going to recommend the Player's Handbook for Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition to encourage people to give it a try. But my real recommendation will actually be a actual play Dungeons and Dragons 5th Edition podcast called I Cast Fireball, run by a dungeon master named Thomas Brower. And it's a very family-friendly, very great way to get introduced even further into Dungeons and Dragons through a really great story from it and a lot of shenanigans, really weird characters that you just fall in love with. And you want to see their really crazy ideas just somehow magically work, because they usually do magically work out somehow, because the dice are usually in their favor at the last minute. So it's a great little podcast. I believe you can find it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and I think most major podcast platforms.
Thank you all for those recommendations. We will have links to all of these on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. Buying through these links helps support our podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and the beautiful in pop culture. We also wanted to shout out a recent episode from one of our fellow Public Square Media podcasts, Sky and Preston. We mentioned, I think at one point, we're going to rebrand as Sky and Amanda. Preston has moved on to a new degree, and now Sky and his wife are hosting the podcast. And so they've started doing their podcast together, and their episode that was released on March 24th is on identity and the ways that the world wants us to think of identity and the ways that the gospel would rather have us think of it, and trying to draw the best from the worldly perspective, but also making sure we're grounded in the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. And I thought it was a really interesting and good discussion as they launch into their new podcast format with the two of them there. Sounds like in their living room, hoping their daughter doesn't wake up. But we wish them all the best in their rebrand. And I really enjoyed that particular episode of the podcast. And now on to our main discussion of Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves. I feel like we need to do a little bit of an explanation really quick, because we've already started dropping terms in that your average Latter-day Saint listener to our podcast may not understand. I remember when I taught a class on Mormonism at Georgetown, I had them read a very short introduction to Mormonism, because I said, I'm liable to drop terms like I'm a temple recommend holding active member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints without explaining what it means to be active or temple recommend holding or what that is. So Dungeons & Dragons, the game, which is not the movie, we'll get to that, is basically make-believe with rules. You're going to try to play fantasy heroes. You're going to try to save the princess or defeat the dragon, or maybe sometimes you'll save the dragon from the princess or whatever's going on. And you roll dice to see what the outcomes are. Maybe try to climb a wall. Maybe the dice will say, nope, you got a low enough score that you tried to climb the wall and you fell down and have to try to go around a different way or something. And so you can listen to real play, which is people really talking and performing it live. That's had an explosion recently. Shannon talked about being the DM, the dungeon master, the referee, and the one who creates the world and sends you on the adventure. And it's just a very weird and bizarre hobby, but one that I have found very fun and useful. And this movie takes place in the generic Dungeons & Dragons world, where there are different groups like the Harpers. They mentioned the Emerald Enclave. There are different cities and towns and realms and nations all mixed together. And they just go on a fantasy adventure. To sum up the plot very briefly, Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez are Holga and Edgin, barbarian and bard, who got into some trouble trying to steal an item to bring back Edgin's deceased wife. And they're in prison, and they get out and have to try to reconnect with his daughter, find out what happened to their former partners who sold them up the river, and save the world while trying to bring his wife back from the dead so that he can redeem and put their family back the way it should have been and not have his daughter suffer the consequences of the mistakes that he's made. And they gather together a motley crew of people and have a series of adventures to try to have all these things happen. And I found it delightful. I wouldn't say it's a great movie, but I had a great time watching it. And I went with Shannon and a bunch of other people from my area here in the sort of the DC suburbs. But I am curious what other people thought just in general about the movie as a whole. Parker, let's actually have you go first. What did you think about the movie? Just some general high-level thoughts.
So I should preface this explanation and my thoughts with the fact that me and my wife went and saw the movie with our Dungeons & Dragons group. And so I sat next to my wife on one side, and my dungeon master was sitting on the other side of me with the rest of our own motley crew, if you will, enjoying the movie and sitting there pointing, I know that spell, I know that spell, I know that class, I know that setting, I know what a red wizard is, I know all this terminology. I truly felt that the filmmakers had taken what would actually happen at a Dungeons & Dragons physical table where people are rolling dice, trying to role play and act things out, and taking that and actually putting it on the screen. Because I felt like I was essentially listening or watching almost an actual play. It just had a much bigger budget behind it. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm hoping to see it again, actually. I enjoyed it that much.
Liz, what are your high-level thoughts about this? As the, I think, the newbiest of us as far as the actual game of Dungeons & Dragons, Because I don't think you need to know all the references, like what a Red Wizard is or whatever, to enjoy the movie, though.
No. And I have never played Dungeons & Dragons. I did do one role-playing session, like, as a family with our family. We tried to get into it during the pandemic, but I just don't like acting. So anyway, it did not go well for me. My son is in a Dungeons & Dragons group, though. And I did used to read the dungeon manuals in the bookstore because I like lists and tables as a teenager. I really enjoyed this movie. I was not sure what to expect from it since the IP that it's based on is mostly like a setting and mechanics, like you said, like spells and different groups and things. But the story is what's a wild card in this case, which is very different from a normal adaptation where the story is pretty set and that's what you're looking like doesn't do well by the story. I thought it was a really fun movie. One of the reviews I read said it was Princess Bride-like, and I think it hit that kind of like fantasy that's not taking itself too seriously, campy, but also just like really good humored and lots of fun and quick moving and enjoyable overall. So I really enjoyed the movie, even though I'm sure some of the Dungeons and Dragons references went right over my head.
I think the comparison to The Princess Bride is a fair one. I have heard it said that The Princess Bride is a Dungeons and Dragons game itself. Like, you've got the farm boy who turns into the world's most famous pirate, right? You've got the gentleman who is the world's strongest man and the best fighter, and just, you know, these weird people who come together to have this adventure, and it all works out really well in the end. So I think that's a fair comparison. A movie with a lot of heart, but that doesn't take itself too seriously either.
Yeah.
Shannon, what are your high-level thoughts about the movie, having come to see it with me and some of our local Dungeons & Dragons friends here in Washington, D.C.?
I loved it, too. I was looking forward to it for weeks before it came out. It's not the kind of movie that changes the way you see the world or anything like that, but it was just really enjoyable 2 hours, and I felt like they loved the game. They weren't trying to be like too cool about it or snarky. Like, they just embraced the whole game and just went with it, and I thought that was really fun to see. And I loved the character of Holga. I don't know why, I really identified with her a lot, and I just thought it was really nice, like the relationship that she had with Edgin, that they were like brother and sister, and she never left him. A lot of times you have that best friend and then they have a fight and the best friend leaves and then they have to run after them and apologize. But even when she was upset with them, she still never left. And I thought that was pretty cool. So I give it 2 thumbs up.
It's a fair point. The relationship between there aren't main characters, but the lead characters of these two who get the crew together. And then once the crew's together, it all just becomes an ensemble cast moment. But the relationship is completely platonic. He's trying to resurrect his dead wife, and she has an ex-husband in a hilarious scene, because you find out it's a hobbit, like, or a halfling, right? We can't use the term hobbit in Dungeons & Dragons because it's been trademarked by the Tolkien estate. But so fun to just see a good relationship that doesn't have any romantic subplot. There's even a moment where he, like the joke, right? He says, oh, I could kiss you. And she's like, try it. Yeah. And that's not their relationship, but it worked really well.
I was just going to say, it's kind of refreshing to not have that romantic tension as one of the main plot points. There's not really a romantic storyline in this, except for between, you guys will have to help me with the races, the wizard and what's her name?
Doric, the druid.
Yeah, Doric. So there's a very cute little relationship with them, but it's very slight. And sometimes it's refreshing to have a movie that doesn't revolve around romance. I'm interested as a non-D&D player to hear about some of the references that those of us who are not D&D people, who go with our D&D family and friends to see it, the references that will go over our head that we should be watching for. What was the funnest little in-joke? Parker, you already talked about some of the spells and things that you recognized, but what were the laugh-out-loud moments that you wouldn't get if you hadn't played Dungeons & Dragons?
I knew this movie was going to be good from some of the trailers where Simon the Sorcerer has the ability to cast Speak with Dead, animating these corpses into a state in which they can divulge information. I felt like it was a scene where the dungeon master, as the corpse, was taking everything super literally and causing confusion amongst the party members, because he would not address the course, but he would look at Simon and say 4 more questions, but then the course would be like,
yes,
No, that wasn't for you. Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Only answer when I talk to you, okay?
Yes.
Why did you say okay at the end of that?
I didn't.
And just falls right back down, never to be animated ever again. And so, of course, in typical D&D fashion and in typical D&D logic, obviously the solution is to dig up more graves and desecrate more grave sites in order to get the information that they're wanting. It's very much what would happen at a Dungeons & Dragons table. And as soon as I saw that scene, even though it was in the trailer, it's still one of my favorites. It just hit all the right buttons for me. And my dungeon master next to me is like, huh. And I'm like, oh no. Another aspect of that scene, though, was the fact that Dor does look at Simon because he's like, you can answer 5 questions. And then they just go back down and she looks at him and she's like, why is it that way? I don't know. That's just always been that way. And the reason is because he verbatim, word for word, practically quoted out of the player's handbook what the spell does. And there's no rhyme or reason as to why the spell is that way. It just is. And even him as a character was perplexed. I don't know why it's 5 questions. Yeah. That doesn't, why 5? Why not 10 or 12 or whatever? So that was the other aspect of the scene that some people who saw that might have found that funny, but didn't realize that Simon did when he explained the spell. He was word for word quoting right out of the player's handbook.
One of the references that I think is a deep cut that even I was unaware of because I would not have watched this show. I would have been too young. Dungeons & Dragons has been around since 1974. And so its 50th anniversary is next year. And they're relaunching the game and putting new core rule books out. So if you're looking to get into it, there really isn't going to be a better time than the next year or two. But they did have an animated TV show in the 1980s that ran from 84 to 85. I don't know. I'd have to go look it up on Wikipedia, but I was 3 at the time, so I wasn't really watching Saturday morning cartoons even yet. But in the scene where they're in the games with the moving maze and the creatures chasing them around, one of the other gladiator groups that's competing in the games are the characters from the animated 1980s Saturday morning cartoon TV show.
Wait, is that us?
And so I just thought that was a great little throwback there. So much of a throwback that I had to have it pointed out to me, but I enjoyed that a lot. There is so much history that goes into a movie like this, that they've been building this world for literally decades and decades. That's actually one of my complaints about the movie, is that there's a lot about the geopolitical sort of situation that doesn't make a lot of sense because they didn't build the world of Faerun that way. They just threw a swamp here and said, oh, there's some dragons here. They're looking for these old artifacts, and they're twin dragons. They're looking for the crowns of the 2 twin kings who died here thousands of years ago. Why? No reason. We're just going to throw it there because that's a cool story. And then you have this pastiche of cool stories that is fun and cool, but someone like me wants maybe a little more of a realistic approach.
It's definitely not Grandpa Tolkien's cup of tea, right? Tolkien he gets abominable. What is this? None of this world building makes sense. None of your languages make sense. But it's the kind of world building that works in a lighthearted fantasy film. And it's great. We're used to these more serious, like very taking themselves seriously fantasy properties like Wheel of Time, Rings of Power, even Game of Thrones.
We got
to get into the geopolitical situation. It has to feel realistic. And this is, no, we're just going to have fun. And that's okay.
Yeah. I think my favorite joke was just the whole Jarnathan thing, partly because I play a bird person in my game, so I was really excited just to see him at all. But also, I think like everyone who's been a dungeon master has had someone ask you the name of some random person in the bar, and you just have to come up with something, and Jarnathan just sounds like something that would just pop out, and then you're like, oh no.
And now you're stuck with this guy for the rest of the campaign because they're like, what's this random guard's name?
And then they're going to fall in love with him and they have to keep showing up. So I really love that part. And I don't know if you noticed who the portrait was, either of you who... Well, so I've been reading, because my campaign that I do is in the Forgotten Realms. And so I've been looking at some of the older, like 3.5 books, and they have Bolo's Guide to Neverwinter, Bolo's Guide to Waterdeep. And so the guy in the portrait is Volo. I don't know his full name. It's like Volan Camp or something like that. But so that was a deep dive that probably most people didn't catch. But I recognize this picture from the cover of the books.
That also is a good sign for the movie, usually. Like, when they really get deep into the lore and really care about it, it usually means it's going to end up being a good movie, even if you don't know the lore.
Mm-hmm.
The opposite of the 1990s Super Mario Brothers movie, where they just, like, totally ignored everything about the canon and you knew it was a big crappy movie because it had nothing to do with why people loved that property. But this one, they really cared a lot about it, it felt.
Yeah. And then I think the Paladin character was another great joke. Just the way that he seems like he came in from a dungeon master, putting him there to drop a bunch of lore and save people and show them which way to go and then just walk off again.
That's almost the way we think of Gandalf in The Hobbit, like this super high powered character. Why is he hanging out with this random group of dwarves? We don't know. But we're sure glad he shows up occasionally to stop the trolls and turn them into stone or whatever. But absolutely, I felt as well that, oh, this is someone who's here to info dump on the people, just to give us some plot coupons so that we can go turn them in later and get our reward. I also liked the Paladin because in older editions of the game, Paladins all had to be a certain way. And for those of you who know about the little nine-square alignment chart memes that you've probably seen running around, they always had to be lawful good back in the day. And 5th edition, the current edition, has changed that, I think, for the better. There was a running gag among older players back in the day that lawful good meant lawful stupid. Like, you just had to do the right thing no matter how dumb or inane, or you had to act as self-righteously as possible. And this character seemed to embody that, but in a way that felt a little more believable and fun while still poking fun of that trope of the super self-righteous, I am good and we're going to do good because goodness is awesome and we're going to do good things because why would you not be good? And that's just his character motivation and that's it. But I had such a great time and he stole the show and I was sad when he left, but then I'm like, actually, it's good you're not here anymore because you were outshining the rest of the cast, and that actually doesn't work in an ensemble cast situation.
I was a little bit disappointed because he had this interesting backstory, and then there's this hint that he got halfway transformed somehow, and I wanted to know more about that, and then he left. But you're right that he's the god-level character, and if he was there, he solves all their problems, and it's not fun anymore.
I felt that all the characters in their respective D&D classes really embodied the class. Edgen's character as a bard really shined at what the bard does. The bard doesn't necessarily get into the nitty gritty of it. They're amazing support characters for the whole party. And in Edgen's case, he was the planner for the whole party and trying to help them and inspire them, or in D&D terms, use bardic inspiration for his crew. And same thing with the Paladin character. Was absolutely a Dungeon Master's NPC. Get in there, do what's necessary to help the cast survive this portion of the campaign. And once that's done, oh, you got the item. Okay, he'll just move on. And the fact that he just walked in a straight line perfectly down the beach. And even Edgen was like, yeah, he's still walking. He's walking straight line. Oh, there's a rock. What's he? Of course, he would go over the rock. Just very typical, just off-screen, dead set. You have no idea where he's going, but he's just going off-screen.
Thought we could talk a little bit about some of the moral themes of the film as a whole, because I like, Liz, your example of The Princess Bride. There's some good things to be drawn from here. Even if it's not taking itself super seriously and is fun, but two that I wanted to bring out that I was surprised by a little bit was that at the end, they have the choice. Spoilers ahead now at this point. We're well into spoiler territory. They have the choice whether to bring back Edgen's deceased wife, the mother of his daughter, who doesn't remember her mother at all, or to bring back Holga, who has now died because she's been stabbed by the Red Wizard's blade and can only be brought back by this powerful artifact.
Who's his daughter's, like, pseudo-mother, right? Her foster mother, basically, who's helped him raise her.
I wish they'd set that up a little bit better. Like, at that moment, there are suddenly a bunch of flashbacks to her raising her. They didn't set that up as well as they could have. But the daughter explicitly says, no, I want you to bring back this woman who has raised me, and I'm sorry that means you're not going to get to see your wife, my mother. But in this moment, this is the choice we have, and this is the right decision for us to make, is to bring... You've been chasing this for the purpose of bringing back your wife, my mom, this whole time, but now the situation has changed just a little bit and we need to make a different decision here. And I really like that sort of interesting concept of deciding together, putting the needs of the children in this case over, because the 17-year-old girl, what's she going to do now that her mom's resurrected? Oh, hi. So like a time skip for the mom would be interesting. But no, I want the woman who raised me back. And I don't know. I just thought that was interesting moral decision that they make there at the end.
I liked it a lot as well, too. I don't think we see enough in film adults deciding on purpose to sacrifice some of their happiness for a child. In this case, he's decided that his romantic needs are less important than his daughter's needs to have her mother figure that she's most attached to. And it's just direct like that. And there's no, oh, in the end, we're going to magically solve both problems with this. No, they're not going to get together. It's still just him choosing to be a better person and put the child ahead of himself, which is really cool.
Yeah, and I think he was trying to assuage his guilt partly because it really was his fault that his wife got killed. And so I think that he had to learn to let it go. He could still let go of his guilt even though he didn't bring his wife back, and to know that he was giving a mother to his child. I really like that. It made me cry. I don't usually cry in movies, and I was trying really hard not to, but that part, I think, was really emotional for a lot of people.
I think it's interesting that Edgen's decisions to pursue this artifact to bring back his wife it's a mixed bag. I'm sure part of him did want his daughter to actually get to know her mother, his wife. But I think as time went on, I think it became more about erasing guilt and erasing bad decisions in the wrong way. And by doing that, he not only lost his wife, but he was slowly losing his daughter in the process. But by choosing and respecting her decision to bring Holga back, that's when I feel like the daughter and father's relationship truly was mended and was solidified again.
It almost makes an interesting statement about repentance, because this is his mistake, and we find out near the end that, like, literally he did something wrong and it caused his wife's death. It caused the Red Wizards to come after him. It's not just his work being a Harper, which is like a non-profit Justice League kind of thing. For those of us who don't know D&D, so he's doing that, and then he gets tired of not getting paid for it, so he steals some money, and the Red Wizards track him down because of that and kill his wife. So he spends the whole movie literally trying to go back in time almost, and we're just going to put this all back exactly the way it was and fix it. And only when he says, no, I actually can't fix that, but I can go forward and I can be better, he can decide to honor his Harper oath and actually do good in the world and to give his daughter the mother that she has rather than the mother she could have had. Like, when he moves forward instead of trying to fix or deny his mistakes in the past, that's when he moves forward, which is an interesting thought on repentance for us, because sometimes we get so obsessed with trying to deny our own mistakes that we can't move forward. We're just trying to pretend like that bad thing never happened instead of growing from it. Reminds me of the Stormlight Archive, but I won't bring up any more Brandon Sanderson.
Parker, I know you wanted to bring that up a little bit, that line between Zank and Edgin about oaths and covenants, and Edgin's failure to live up to his Harper covenant, I'm so Latter-day Saint, his oath to be a Harper and the Paladin. Anyway, go ahead, and you wanted to say something about that.
So I'll just, for a little more D&D reference for the listeners, Paladin's power comes from his oath that he has made. And so coming from the Paladin character, it has a lot more weight to those who have played D&D in any way, shape, or form, or are familiar with it in any way, shape, and form. But yeah, when he stated to Edgin that you may have forgotten your oath, but your oath has not forgotten you, I am, even in the middle of the theater, in the middle of just nostalgia heaven for me, practically, I even recognized that it made me really think about my own covenants that I have made, starting with baptism and forwards, that we're imperfect, and a lot of times we forget about those covenants, those promises, or those oaths that we have made. But the Lord has never, ever forgotten those promises, and let alone those oaths from his point of view, that he always honors them regardless. But just like Egan was able to, in his own way, renew that oath again to do good, so we have that opportunity also to renew those covenants despite any mistakes that we have made. And as we brought up earlier, through repentance, we can get back to that again. And that just really hit home pretty hard for me.
It was a great line. And it's interesting you bring up that game mechanic where you get your power from your oath. Because some paladins swear oaths to particular deities, but some of them just swear oaths to law or to some sort of cosmic force or ideal, but it still grants them literal magic power in the game. And that is something that I feel like President Nelson would have something to say about spiritual power flowing to us by following the covenant path. But I don't know, maybe we'll start getting a little blasphemous if I go too far down that road. But there are lessons to be learned there. And that's one of the things I appreciated about the movie, is that there were some lessons to learn, even amongst all the shenanigans and the Jarnathan moments and what have you. They had some good stuff to say. Another thought that I wanted to bring up, a moral theme, is just the idea of teamwork. Because when you play the game itself, there are usually 3 to 5 of you. I've run for as many as 6 once. That was a nightmare. I do not recommend it. But there's a group of people, and you have different skills, you have different abilities, you have different strengths, different weaknesses. And it's very much a group project to try to figure out how you're going to, whatever you have going on. And it was fun to see everybody doing their different thing. Holga's great at fighting. Simon's very good at thinking on his feet and thinking with portals, for those of you who have ever played any of the Portal games. I thought they all complemented each other really well. And when they really got towards the end, and they felt like they got better and better at it as they went, especially the moment where they're trying to sneak into the vault by putting the portal on this thing. And I don't even want to have to explain the whole convoluted thing they do, but they're all working at it. They all have to play their part in order for this really convoluted plan to work out. And it does. It was fun to watch that become a strength of the party as they slowly got better and better and working with each other and using each other's abilities and skills and strengths to complement each other. And because I think teamwork's a big part of D&D, and there are literally people who use Dungeons & Dragons to teach this to teenagers who need to learn to get along better or who need a little bit of therapy to be more assertive. And I like that the movie played into that really well, the sort of the idea of teamwork and working off each other and using strengths to shore up other people's weaknesses and things like that. I don't know who was put it in the show notes, but this is similar, at least in some ways, to the idea of the body of Christ, where the head cannot say to the hand, "I have no need of thee." Sometimes you need a druid to sneak into a castle, and other times you need a sorcerer to cast a portal spell, and it all somehow works out together.
As you were mentioning, it's really important to recognize that the talents that we have been given. Take the parable of the talents, for instance. The Lord gives people a certain amount of talents. So in Dungeons & Dragons, a lot of people, when you're playing the barbarian or the fighter or the paladin who can just go in there and do these awesome, amazing things with swords and in combat, because it's a very combat-heavy tabletop role-playing system. And a lot of other people who play supporting characters like bards may not feel that important to the party, but when you realize that your contributions can still, when you put that effort in and you can multiply those talents, it is still immensely beneficial to the whole party. And in real life, when we put those talents toward building the kingdom of God, we find our place there in it. And with that comes that sense of belonging.
I love that they call it out in the movie that, like, the bard is useless. She asks him, "And what do you contribute?" He's, "I make plans." And he has a lute. It's good. "But we already have the plan, so do we really need you?" But turns out they do. They do need him. And he is useful, but he remains not a fighter character. He does not do well at the fighting. And that's okay, and they still need him.
In Dungeons & Dragons, bards have an ability called Bardic Inspiration, where they can add an additional dice to a roll. And sometimes, even when you roll and you feel like you've gotten close to beating that threshold of success, and you roll that additional dice, sometimes you only roll an additional 1 on top of what you initially rolled. And you're like, "I don't know if that's going to cut it." And all of a sudden the dungeon master is like, "That meets the threshold. You've been successful in accomplishing whatever you were trying to do." And so it's amazing what those little dice or just that one additional point can do in our lives. So I don't think we should ever underestimate those talents and abilities we have.
A grain of mustard seed, if you will.
Absolutely. That was a great reference. Yeah, yeah.
So I know quite a few people who are Latter-day Saints who play Dungeons & Dragons, and several of the authors that I follow in the sci-fi fantasy realm play Dungeons & Dragons who are LDS. And I'm wondering if this is a pattern. Are there more LDS players of Dungeons & Dragons than other people in general, or even religious people? I'm just curious. Maybe I'm just friends with only the nerds in the church, so I have no idea. But what's your guys' experience been like?
You bring up an interesting point. You feel like you're only friends with the nerds in the church, but there are a lot of nerds in the church. When I had to leave the Rockville ward and move into the Kensington ward, I went to my first little shindig with the ward, and I said, where are the nerds here? And they're like, oh, go talk to Sister Andrea because she runs the Sci-Fi and Fantasy Book Club. And I was like, sold, instant friends. It was great. But I think, Liz, you're aware that per capita, we buy more fantasy books than other groups. Like Utah has a higher per capita fantasy consumption. And it is also absolutely true, and we'll put this in the show notes, that Utah and Idaho are like the number one and number two states per capita of people who play Dungeons and Dragons. So yeah, it's a thing among us.
Hey, this is Carl and Liz interjecting from the future here. Liz asked this question about Latter-day Saints playing D&D, and I gave my answer, but after we recorded, an event happened that was well worth talking about in a quick aside. On April 22nd, in the Provo Town Center Mall, a record 1,227 people gathered to play an epic game of Dungeons & Dragons, organized by Andrew Ashby, owner of the We Geek Together store in that mall. The game had over 200 tables, each run by an individual Dungeon Master, as well as one master dungeon master coordinating the entire game. They even had different cosplayers running from table to table as generals, helping coordinate the resistance against the evil Archlich Vecna in an event now known as the Dead Wars. Liz, you weren't there, but you did get some notes from a member of your writing group that was. What did they have to say about it?
He said it was very chaotic in the way you'd expect from having 1,000 people trying to roleplay together. But I imagine it's pretty similar to how it feels on the battlefield, right? They're all having their individual storyline at their table, and then all of a sudden something from the high up event completely makes whatever they're doing change. But it was interesting, and it actually felt like a story, which is really cool to have 1,000 plus people all coordinating a story together. They had actors being like the main people in the center and showing what was happening with the big figures in the battle. And then everybody else was kind of doing their little thing on the battlefield and fighting. It sounded really awesome. I can't believe I didn't remember this during the podcast because I had heard about it. They were recruiting people for it at the LTUE conference in February. So I should have thought that it was happening this weekend.
Yeah, I had seen some stuff about it online as well, and I was thinking, man, if I lived in Utah County, I absolutely would have signed up to be one of the Dungeon Masters at one of those 200 tables. Sounds like a blast, a chaotic blast, but sometimes those are the best ones, and that would have been something I definitely would have participated in, but alas, I live in Maryland, so what do you do? So, it goes without saying that not everybody who lives in Utah County is Latter-day Saint, and certainly not everybody who participated in the Dead Wars is Latter-day Saint. But I am reasonably confident in saying that a lot of Latter-day Saints participated in this Guinness World Record-breaking Dungeons & Dragons event. So we thought we'd just do this quick aside to help further answer Liz's question about Latter-day Saints and Dungeons & Dragons. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
So do you guys mostly play with other members of the church, or do you have play with other people, or how does that usually work? What's the difference? Because we were talking about earlier different live plays you listen to, and some of them are a little more risque than others. Like, my husband tried to watch the animated show that just came out of Critical Role, and he was like, I did not expect to have to do this much fast-forwarding in a cartoon that's about Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, I cannot recommend that animated show very much. I think season two was a little better because they just got more away from that one character's sort of scatological nonsense. And I don't know why they put that so much in. It's okay if he brings it up once every other episode when you're playing for 4 hours a week. That's a fine amount. When you throw it all into one season of 10 episodes of 30 minutes each, it's way too much. And now I forgot your question.
I'm just curious, do you usually play with church members or do you play with mixed groups, or what's the dynamic there, having not played it myself?
I'm curious, Shannon, why don't you go first?
I think it just depends on who invites you to play with. Right now, I'm in a mixed faith group, I think. Like, there's two couples who are LDS, and then I think the other couple is Catholic, and there's my husband and I who are kind of sort of LDS. So I think it just depends, but it does seem like a lot of Mormons like to play games, and maybe it's because you don't go out drinking or other things that maybe other adults would do together to socialize. It's not really available. So I think it's a fun way to get to know other people. And I've only played with one group and then my family. So I don't know if I have a finger on the pulse.
Parker, you run a podcast about all this stuff. What's your experience been?
So in my personal life, I play with mostly other members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But in both the campaign that I run, we had a couple that I was good friends with him, and I got to know his wife because of my friendship with him. They weren't members of the church, but they were very devout Christians, and we had a really fun time. I think a lot of Latter-day Saints gravitate toward mostly other Latter-day Saints because one important aspect in playing Dungeons & Dragons is making sure that you understand boundaries and understanding what's acceptable at the table and what is not. So for Latter-day Saints, things that happen in Critical Role are definitely very off-boundary in role play and topic or even in mentioning it. So it's important to make those establishments. But for me personally, I've played with mixed, and on the podcast, I've gotten to meet a lot of people not of our faith and have just a really great time doing it. So it's been wonderful to get to know them and through a similar hobby, through a common interest. So it's been very wonderful to build off that common ground. And I find that most people are very respectful and they generally pick up on things. And most tabletop role-playing players are very mindful when they notice that they say something, but then it doesn't get mentioned ever again. It's, oh, okay, that may not be acceptable at this table. And that's okay.
It's true, because you can have a dungeon master who wants to run things like Honor Among Thieves or The Princess Bride, or you might have one that wants to run it more like Game of Thrones. And if you show up expecting Honor Among Thieves and you get Game of Thrones, that's going to be those are going to conflict quite a bit. As far as my own experience, I started playing in 2007 with a bunch of my nerd friends who I grew up with and went to high school and middle school with. And then in 2015 or 16, a couple of people in the Rockville ward came up to me and said, "So we've been watching Stranger Things, and it made us realize that we've always wanted to play Dungeons & Dragons since high school, and we know that you're a nerd. Do you play Dungeons & Dragons, and will you run for us?" And, well, that group's been going on and off now for 6 years. It mutated into the group where I first taught Brother Cade, and then he spun off into the group that Shannon's now a part of, but I'm still going with that original group. But another group that I run with right now includes a friend of mine that I met playing World of Warcraft back when I was a World of Warcraft addict, because he lives here in Silver Spring. And I was like, "Hey, Ben, let's play Dungeons & Dragons." And so now it's me and Linda, who is a Latter-day Saint, her husband, Randy, who's Jewish, Raj, who I don't think is particularly anything, but his wife is Jewish, and he makes the most wonderful challah bread when we play on Friday nights, and Ben, who is a lapsed Catholic. And we all get along just wonderfully and fine, and it's a great time with just a different group of people. And I think that is one of the joys of Dungeons & Dragons, is if you find a good group of people, you will get together, and I know it's just make-believe with rules, but you can come up with some really fun stories. When you talk about it with your coworkers on Monday, or when your coworkers on Monday overhear, you're like, "Oh yeah, I was totally, and then we fought this dragon, and then this other lady showed up, and it turns out that she's actually," and you're just talking, and they're like, "What? You did what over the weekend?" Because you're talking as if you were the person. Don't say, "My character slew the dragon." You say, "I slew the dragon." And it's just so wonderfully immersive and fun to create these stories together. And you don't know how it's going to turn out. And that's part of the fun. But yeah, in my case, though, one group that I've been running for online for a while is all LDS. That's just because it's my basic friends. But another one is mixed. And we still have a great time doing it. But yeah, like Parker said, setting expectations is good. If you show up to a Game of Thrones game expecting The Princess Bride, you're going to have a bad time, because that's a major misalignment. And you can do either in Dungeons & Dragons. It just depends on what kind of game you want to. In the movie, obviously, they're going more for the fun, light, not super serious vibe, but still, as we've discussed, some tender moments and some good morals that could be drawn out as well, even though it's not like a capital G great work of art.
I have to say, Almost Thou convinces me to be a D&D player. The experiences you guys describe are really great, and I like this idea of people getting together and doing something creative as a method of bonding. I found this article while I was researching what in the world can we talk about for moral themes for Dungeons & Dragons, called Playing Dungeons & Dragons with Mormons, and it's written by somebody who's a non-member who was invited by a member to play Dungeons & Dragons with them. And I like this quote from the article, which we'll link in the show notes. It says, I could have called this article Playing Magic the Gathering with Catholics, or Playing Badminton with East Asians, or even Playing Smash Brothers with people from non-traditional families. Rack your brain, and I'm sure you can think of examples from your own life in which you first interacted with someone from a different background on a basketball court, in an arcade, or across a poker table. For all the effort we waste in looking for high-minded ways to generate unity, the solution has been right in front of us all along. I really like that idea that Dungeons & Dragons brings people together and you interact over a long period of time doing something you love together. And there's not enough of that in American society nowadays. Like, regular meetings of groups have gone down. So I think it's a valuable hobby and I applaud all of you.
Yeah. It is interesting. I think one of the reasons the game has had a renaissance the past few years is, first of all, I think the people who run Wizards of the Coast, which is a company that owns it, had no idea that Stranger Things was going to be a thing and then make everybody, like, again, that's one of the reasons why I got into the current groups that I'm in, is because people said, hey, we saw Stranger Things, let's get into it. Last year, Critical Role was the number one Twitch stream. They made $9 million just playing Dungeons and Dragons and having people listen to them, because at least in that case, they're all professional voice actors. So they're like professional charming people. And so the game is very different than the one that I would play, because I can't do voices and I can't improv act the way they do. But I think part of the reason it's had such a renaissance is because earlier, Parker, you mentioned that the budget for the movie, you felt like it was better than the budget for your game. So I forget exactly how you phrased it. Part of me wanted to say, no, but that's the beauty of it, is you just put some M&Ms down on the table. You're like, all right, those are the goblins, go kill them. And then you can imagine that in your head. And like when I run D&D for some of the youth in my ward, it's a very non-digital experience, right? They're not in their phones. They're not sitting there watching a screen, or like, it is a live analog experience using their imagination. And that's also something I think that we don't get enough today. And I think is one of the reasons why they sold almost $1 billion worth of Dungeons and Dragons books last year. And I don't think that was just the pandemic. Like, it just keeps going up every year. And it's the hobby has had an interesting renaissance of late. So I suppose there's one thing we should talk about very briefly, and that is like the satanic panic nonsense. I don't know if anybody wants to, what maybe had you heard about Dungeons and Dragons, why you should not want to play it, or maybe people are going to call us bad for saying people should play it, or that we do play it, or we're bad Latter-day Saints, or I don't know, whatever. Parker, do you have anything to say about the overwrought panics of the Karens from the 80s who thought that playing... I'm giving away my view of it, but...
I have fortunately not had a personal experience with that. I grew up with parents that one of the highlight qualities of my parents was that they were very trusting toward their children. They taught them correct gospel principles and they trusted them to be able to govern themselves because of it. And so when I was an adult and got invited by my current Dungeon Master to play, because he's like, hey, you love Tolkien and Lord of the Rings? And I was like, yes, most people who know me, that's the first fact they learn about me. What about it? And he's, you're going to love Dungeons and Dragons. It's like, I don't know if I'm ready to go down that particular rabbit hole. And now I run a podcast and all that kind of stuff now. So I did go down the rabbit hole. But
yeah,
I never had anybody really talk about it. I've only heard about the satanic panic revolving around Dungeons and Dragons through hearsay and from other people's experiences. And some of those experiences are actually really heartbreaking, honestly, because it's such a wonderful hobby that, as we were mentioning and alluded to, it teaches such wonderful social skills. For a lot of people, it's very therapeutic. I know a lot of psychologists and counselors that utilize Dungeons and Dragons or other tabletop role-playing systems to help with those skills. And it's such a great bonding experience and getting to know new people from different backgrounds, just like your characters are in Dungeons and Dragons. But for some reason, people can't get over the fact that in the monster manual, there is a stat block for a devil. There's a stat block for a demon. And I know the closest I ever came to this experience was I actually bought the starter set for my younger cousins. And my aunt was like, so this is okay, right? And by this point, I had heard about it and I was suspecting that she was alluding to it. Not that she didn't trust me, but just her own, when she grew up, she had never played, probably partly because of this. And I said, it can be whatever you want. If they don't want to play with demons and devils in it, just toss it. It doesn't have to be in the game. It doesn't have to be part of the lore. It doesn't have to be anything. Dungeons and Dragons is whatever you make of it.
I'd be curious, Shannon, why you decided to run for your family. And back to the question, if you've heard anything about why, as a stay-at-home mom of three kids, why did you want to start playing this with your kids?
Mostly because the game I was playing was only once a month and I needed my fix more often than that. So that's why I started. But I just thought it would be fun. And they're getting a little older. And so they're actually like really fun to play with now. Like they're creative and they have their own ideas. And the thing I really love about playing just for my family is that I'm telling a story, but I only have an audience of three people and I'm tailoring it just for them. I want to make them feel really cool and I want to figure out which magic item they would love to get and give it to them. And so it's really fun just to think about what their fantasy is and try to fulfill it for them. I hadn't really heard anything. The only thing I knew, I don't think I knew anyone who played Dungeons and Dragons in high school. I think there were some Magic the Gathering people, and I just mostly thought it was for boys and that they dressed weird. That was kind of my impression.
LARPing is a whole different thing that
we're not covering that. But my dad, actually, I sent him a little photo of what our minifigures fighting goblins and the farm. And I was like, oh, look, the goblins. And now he's interested in it, actually. And so when they come visit, I'm going to try to play with them and show them. So maybe I can introduce my dad to it.
Then I can have a great grandson in Dungeons and Dragons term. I've already given the plot away. For those who are thinking that maybe Dungeons and Dragons is not appropriate for Latter-day Saints, just be aware that the people who say Dungeons and Dragons is literally satanic are the same people who think that Harry Potter actually teaches you witchcraft and that we sacrifice goats in our temples. We do not. Harry Potter does not teach that. Dungeons and Dragons does not actually teach you to worship Satan. These are deeply unserious people who we should not engage with.
Can I ask you about your religious system in your game? I'm just wondering, since it's a LDS podcast, about what kind of gods you have in the game that you're running for your friends.
So it's interesting because I'm running three campaigns, four if you count the one with the youth in my ward, even though we haven't met since October. But two of them are running predetermined adventures where it's a book that you buy that's already, this is what happens and these are the monsters you fight and here's what the plot is and here's how to direct the players to go through it. And so we have the religious system that it comes with there. But even in the online written campaign that I've been doing now for almost 12 years, and we can put a link to that one in the show notes because we've started slowly releasing it because it's like writing a fantasy novel as a group exercise. I still use the pantheon that existed in the third edition, which is when we started playing it. And it is a polytheistic universe. There are different gods and they have different moral views on things. And there are different, you could play it in a monotheistic world. That would actually, I think, be really interesting. And I've always wondered what would it be like if somebody wanted to roll like a genuinely monotheistic character who's just, no, Pelor is the one true god. And the rest of you are all worshiping false gods. What would that look like?
Is this where I throw in that I found a Book of Mormon Dungeons and Dragons expansion while I was researching for this episode?
Dungeons and Dragons is a rule set that you could impose on any kind of world. If you wanted to make paladins and clerics and make them all Nephites fighting Gadianton robbers in Mesoamerica in the 200 BCE era, you could absolutely do that because you can take the Book of Mormon and do what you want with it. And there are probably supplements that you could use to integrate like Mesoamerican sort of
culture and architecture, and maybe the bad guys worship the Mesoamerican gods. You could do anything you wanted with this sort of rule set that exists. But I do use the traditional, just the deities and the pantheons that exist there, because I find that, at least in my own games, starting with what they give me and then working outward from there, I find much more creatively interesting than just starting with a blank canvas and going, what am I going to put on that?
And there's so many interesting gods already.
Right. Although I do have an idea for a character once that I want to play that's like an atheist. Not in the sense that he doesn't believe in the gods, but in the sense that this person is like, no, the gods are just more powerful beings than us. They're not worthy of worship. Give me enough time and study and I could become as powerful as them. So they're not special. They're just more advanced. And it's a difference of degree, not a difference of kind.
You're describing Yasna Kolin in the Stormlight Archive.
Sure. I'm sure that this kind of idea has existed. The kind of person who, to get into the nitty gritty just for a half a second of the game mechanics, sees no difference between a warlock pact with their patron and a cleric's covenant with their god. And that they think that's the same thing. But anyway, that's maybe getting a little too nitty gritty. But if you wanted to play a monotheistic world with a god who had maybe angels who assisted him, and then a devil who had demons or other devils who assisted him, but there are just two poles and that's it. You've got goodness and then you've got evil, and that was the world that you played in. You could absolutely run a game like that and you would have a fun time doing it. If that's what you wanted to do, you could tell stories that way and it would be wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously it's a hobby that I enjoy a great deal and I can't recommend it enough. It may not be for everyone, but I think everyone would have at least a fun time playing it once or twice. And you never know. Maybe you'll end up like Shannon. You end up running for your family and introducing your dad to it. But back to the movie. Let's get to our rating segment then. We have three ratings that we rate all of our movies on. And the first is clean versus objectionable material. And our rating system is celestial, terrestrial, telestial, and outer darkness. I'd be curious to see where people put this. Liz, why don't we have you go first on this one? How would you rate this movie, Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, for its content?
I probably would just put it on celestial. I don't think there's anything that's very uncomfortable. There is violence, but it's generally very G-rated violence. There's not blood, and there's lots of cut away when we chop off someone's head or things are further away. There is like only one sexual innuendo joke, which is pretty rare to find in an adult movie.
It's a great family movie. That's a good point. Yeah. Parker, what do you think you'd give this one on our scale of the Mormon afterlife?
I would also honestly put it at a celestial level, because I would feel comfortable taking any of my younger cousins or inviting friends with their kids or anything like that. I just don't see anything that would be alarming in any way, shape, or form.
Shannon, how about you?
Yeah, I agree. My parents are pretty conservative about what they watch, and I would feel fine taking them to this movie. I will say my 14-year-old, he came home and said that it was scary. And I was surprised because he watches like horror films that I wouldn't want to watch just because I don't like being scared. And so I think the Dark Wizard, like some of it, just the makeup and kind of the menacing aspect of it all is might be scary for little kids. But I saw a lot of kids that looked like they were 6 or 7 in the theater that looked like they were having a great time. So I'd say celestial.
I'm going to be a little contrarian and say terrestrial, but just in the sense that there are a couple of moments that might be a little uncomfortable, depending on how tuned you are into things that are scary or if you're object to violence or whatever. I would have a great time with anybody. I would have a great time. I think there were 12 of us who went to go see it together. It was a good time, but there are a couple moments. It is PG-13 and for good reason, although maybe work with me here for a moment. PG-13 was a rating that was created because of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Because it was originally rated PG, and Steven Spielberg was like, I don't think this is PG. Like, it's not rated R, but it's not. And so they made PG-13 to fit in between those two. I think if we were pre-Raiders of the Lost Ark, this movie would be PG, which is still parental guidance suggested. And so that's why maybe I'm going to give it terrestrial. Anyway, our second one is artistic merit skillful, effective use of craft. And I'm going to have Parker lead off on this one. We rate things on 1 to 5 popcorn balls, 5 being a really great, just good use of writing and special effects and acting and all that together. What do you think you'd give this movie on a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn balls?
I would probably give it a 4.5. I felt like what we mentioned earlier, they were very true to the source material. They were very true to the spirit of what Dungeons & Dragons is all about. They were very true to showcasing classes in a way that would make anybody who played that class feel important and powerful in their own right. So I think they did a really good job showcasing that with all the effects and whatnot. So I would say probably a 4.5. There are some aspects that I think they could have done a little differently, but I would definitely rate it on the higher end for sure.
Shannon, how about you go next? What would you give this one on a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn balls?
I would say maybe a 3.5. I loved the movie because I love Dungeons & Dragons, but I don't think it's going to win any awards. It's just, it's an average movie, I guess, as far as the storyline. And I did think the acting was really good, though. I might bump it up to a 4.5 just because of the acting.
I'll go next. I think I'm going to give this one 5 popcorn balls. And this is just maybe my own idiosyncratic approach to such things. I rate a movie for how well it did what it was going for. You're right, Shannon. This is not going to win any awards. But they were going for a fun-filled time at the movies that was just goofy and lighthearted and silly, with maybe a couple of tender and touching moments and some emotional weight to just occasionally seen here or there. If that's what they were going for, they absolutely succeeded. So I'm going to give it 5 popcorn balls. But yes, you're right. This isn't a great work of art, but it was sure fun. Liz, what would you give this on a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn balls?
I think I'm going to give it a 4, and I definitely agree with you that it does depend on your expectations. If you go in expecting Lord of the Rings, this is not Lord of the Rings. This is definitely a comedy fantasy, but really fun, really well done. I can't believe we've made it this far into the podcast without talking about the chubby dragon, which was the best part of the movie. I love the chubby dragon. Yeah, I thought they did some new things that I haven't seen. I've read a good amount of humorous fantasy, and like that chubby dragon was definitely a new thing for me, that like he's trying to get them and he just can't do anything because he's just, oh, it was really cute and really funny. And just the gelatinous cube move at the end is really fun. So just some new, fun, humorous fantasy, and the CGI works for me. It didn't break for me at any point where I was like, I can see the strings here. This isn't quite working. Acting is great. So I'm going to give it 4. I don't know what I think could have been better, but it's a great movie. I don't know that I'll be back watching it the same way I would like The Princess Bride. So I guess 5 would be The Princess Bride in this category of movies.
I will say that my dungeon master, when he saw the chubby dragons, I may have to use this now because he thought it was hilarious. He's like, I have to view dragons in a completely different way, that they're almost like people where there's fat ones or skinny ones. I got to think outside the box with dragons now. And so we're both excited and terrified at what he will come up with. So,
you know, look at the people on the cover of Dragon Monthly or Dragon's World or whatever. That's an unrealistic expectation of what a dragon should look like.
Really, if you spend all your time laying on your hoard, you probably gain a few pounds.
Right. And I love that joke. It's like, he moved layers. What did he do? Eat the last one? It's just this throwaway line that's just so great. And I can't believe we've been this far into the conversation also without talking about Hugh Grant's character, Forge, who is just hilarious. He's the bad guy, but he's slimy and conniving. He's so funny. Every time he's on screen, you're just like, oh, I hate that guy. But you understand why he became the Lord of Neverwinter. I had so much fun with him, but I'm glad he got his comeuppance at the end. Everybody's acting was very well spot on for what they were going for. And Hugh Grant, it was perfect as like the main bad guy. So yeah, I really enjoyed him as well. All right. And our final rating is Gospel Connections, Morally Edifying Messages, 1 to 5 apricots. This isn't that kind of movie, but there were a couple points we're able to draw out. Parker, I thought your insights were very good. And I'm just curious what people want to give this rating. I'll start with you this time, Shannon.
I mean, it was a lot of like thievery, skullduggery, I guess you would say. But I think the idea of community and helping each other, I think that's one of the most important things in my personal gospel. So I think I would give it a 4, 4.5.
Sure. A lot of themes of found family that I appreciated as well.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Parker, what would you give this one on a scale of 1 to 5 apricots?
I would probably say 3. There definitely were a lot of fun gospel connections that I thoroughly enjoyed and a lot of really wholesome lessons I think just about everybody could benefit from in watching this movie. But I think in the end, as we pointed out, it's just a lighthearted, fun family film, essentially, where it's just a bunch of Dungeons and Dragons shenanigans and whatnot. So I don't think the filmmaker's intent was to teach a lot of moral lessons, per se, in creating this film. But at the same time, there were definitely a lot of fun material. And I'm sure I'll think of a lot more. And I'm sure once I see it a few more times, because I'm definitely going to watch it again, I'm sure I'll make even more gospel connections and lessons to take away in my own life. But for my initial viewing of it, I'm going to stick with 3, maybe 3.5 cuts.
That feels fair to me. I'll give it 3 as well. There's some stuff there, but that's just the stuff you would find in any sort of generic movie where there are good guys and you watch them do good things. Although I really did like your insights on that line from Zank where he says, "You may have forgotten your oath, but your oath has not forgotten you." I feel like that's one I'm going to pull up in a Sunday school class someday or something, or throw up when I teach Online Institute or something as a meme. Because that's a pretty insightful moment for those of us who try to follow the covenant path. But you're right. It's not what they were intending. So I think I'm going to give it 3 as well. Liz, what would you give this one on a scale of 1 to 5?
I'm going to be a little more stingy than the rest of you and give it 2. One is for that oath line and like kind of the discussion of breaking oaths and then coming back to them, which I love that theme. And then the other one is for the ending. So those are my 2 apricots out of this. The ending that parents sacrifice for their children is a good and noble thing to do. So I like those 2. But in general, yeah, it's not like a deep movie or one you go to have a deep discussion, but very enjoyable nonetheless.
It's a great evening at the movies, and sometimes that's just what you need. All right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. If you'd like to follow along or connect with those of us who are here on the podcast, I am on Twitter at Carl Cranny. Liz, where could people find you if they wanted to get in touch with you?
Yeah, you can follow my writing and book reviews at lizlesley.com and find my social media there.
And Parker, where could people get a hold of you and anything you'd like to plug?
I think the best way is through my podcast with my friend Brandon, Nat One Nerds. Again, it's essentially a tabletop role-playing exploration of different systems of not only D&D, but Call of Cthulhu, Pathfinder, Fate, and so forth to help people get introduced in the tabletop community in general, to help people find the system that best fits with what they desire in social gathering. You can find us on most major podcast platforms such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook, and you can also find us on Instagram at NatOneNerdsPodcast.
I got to say, after I invited Parker on, I went and listened to their first episode introducing people to 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, and it's a good podcast. He and Brandon have a good flow of talking and bringing things up, and if you wanted to get into or explore maybe what it would be like to actually play, I'd recommend that as well. And for those of you who maybe be interested in actually running the game, I have a YouTube playlist that I'll put in the show notes as well for those of you who might want to learn how to be a dungeon master. Shannon, is there anything you want to plug, or should we just move on?
I'm kind of burned out on social media. If you want to get in touch, send an email to Carl. He can text me.
There you go. That's right. I'll screen your calls for you, Shannon. Send me a DM and I'll get in touch with Shannon if you need anything. Thank you for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with a friend who enjoys movies and good conversation. You can also subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice, and please leave us a rating or a review. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode or on any episode. If you've ever played Dungeons & Dragons or another role-playing game, we'd love to hear from you about it. Send us a message via email, social media, on our website. It really makes our day as podcast hosts to hear from those who listen to our podcasts. Liz, can you tell us what we're going to be discussing in our next episode?
Next time, we're going to be doing something a little different than we usually do. Instead of talking about a specific film or show, we'll be talking about how mothers are portrayed in media for our Mother's Day special. And we want to hear from you on this as well. Who are your favorite fictional mothers or mother figures? And what's the worst depiction of motherhood you've ever seen? Send your ideas our way and we might discuss them in our next episode. Either way, be ready for that conversation in 2 weeks.
All right, we'll look forward to that.
This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.